Hey, podcast listeners. Lawfare has a new podcast for you. It's called The Report, and it brings you the in-depth story of the Mueller report, but without having to wade through 448 dense pages of legal text. The first episode dropped on Friday, and you'll be able to see it in our feed. But for future episodes, subscribe to The Report wherever you get your podcasts.
So I thought, when I was in office, that we were not doing nearly enough with respect to China and Russia. And the reason I disagreed with the crowd, so to speak, through the 2000 to, say, 2010 period, was that it had become clear to me, I think, before that it was clear to many people, that China and Russia, the China and Russia we'd hoped for in the 90s wasn't happening. And that we needed to be able to counter them, and they were a higher-end enemy than the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. Second, we had spent all that time and energy on Iraq and Afghanistan, and ultimately Syria. And was that a distraction? Yeah, it was. So you put those two things together, and China and Russia weren't getting the attention they needed to from the Defense Department for about 10 years. And one of the things I did in all three of my jobs is try to restore that attention to China and Russia. I think that's now more prevalent in the country, which is a good thing. Prevalent in Washington, which is a good thing. But it wasn't 10 years ago.
I'm Michaela Fogel, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, July 20th, 2019. We've got something a little different for podcast listeners this week. Jack Goldsmith sat down in Cambridge, Massachusetts, to have a conversation with former Secretary of Defense Ash Carter, and you're about to hear it. They talked about Carter's time as head of the Pentagon, the challenges of conveying national security threats to the American public, the Obama administration's response to the rise of the Islamic State, offensive cyber operations, and the role of lawyers in defense policy. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 436. Jack Goldsmith talks to former Secretary of Defense, Ash Carter.
So this is an amazing book on many levels. I learned a ton. And it's many different kinds of book wrapped into one. It's a comprehensive and accessible explanation for how DOD works on topics ranging from acquisitions and procurement to chain of command issues to strategic planning and dozens of other issues. It's a how-to and leadership manual. I don't know if you would accept that characterization.
I would. That's intended to be.
It's full of practical advice for how to deal with the press, the interagency process, congressional hearings, crisis management, and more. It's an assessment of U.S. grand strategy with regard to China, Russia, the Middle East, North Korea. It analyzes DoD's technological strengths and weaknesses in an age of rapid technological change. And all of these things come wrapped in a memoir about your decades of work in the Pentagon. So is that a fair characterization?
That is absolutely fair. And I appreciate your saying that because this is a different kind of book, Jack. It's not a Washington memoir. People tend to think of former officials, everybody who comes out of government writes a memoir. They were born in such and such a year. They come up, and then a lot of who shot John about their time in office. And first of all, my time's been long. I've been doing it for 37 years. But more importantly, the book isn't about Ash Carter. It's about the Department of Defense and about leadership. And I don't know whether you're a nonfiction reader, Jack, but I am. And I like to be taken through nonfiction to a place I've never been and maybe a place I never will be and told how it works. And for those who are curious about the Pentagon, I think this will scratch that itch.
I completely agree. I mean, I worked in the Pentagon for a year in the general counsel's office, and I got to know how it worked a little bit, but I would have loved to have had this book to read before I got there. I mean, it's really no other book like this that explains in practical but accessible terms how everything works. It's really extraordinary.
Although if you were at the general counsel's office, you were at close to the heartbeat.
The crossroads. Everything comes through the law, unfortunately.
It's a very important office. Right. Maybe we can talk about that.
I'd like to later on. It seems like this book, it seems like you had a drawer of reflections that you've been kind of saving up for three or four decades. Is that the right way to think about this book?
Sure.
It really is a lifetime of reflection.
Yeah, it's really a, what did I learn that I wished I had known going in? And let me help someone else know that. Even if they don't have to be in defense or government, but somebody who's trying to lead an enterprise, nothing's going to be as big as the Department of Defense. It's the world's biggest.
Right.
But leaders of all kinds, something that they can, as the orchestra leader for the Philadelphia Orchestra, the one little biographical note I'll add is that I'm from Philadelphia. And he used to say, when asked what his program was going to be, he'd say, I give him something to whistle on the way home. And I hope every leader reads it and has something to whistle.
You gave a lot. And it's not just leaders in the Defense Department. I mean, I think the lessons, and we'll talk about some of them, apply to all parts of the government and to other areas. So I'd like to start with, before you came to work in the Defense Department, you got a DPhil, I guess it was, in Oxford in theoretical physics, and you were on the track to be an academic theoretical physicist, and you even allude to a famous article that you wrote. It's kind of amazing that a theoretical physicist was the Secretary of Defense. Just tell us a little bit about that and it's a great story about how you got from there into the defense world.
Yeah, I was a theoretical physicist. That's all I thought I'd do in my life. I love physics. I loved the particular subfield I was in, which is elementary particle physics. I had done experimental work at Fermilab, the big accelerator, at Brookhaven National Laboratory, another big accelerator, and I thought that's what I was going to do. The connection to defense and how I got into defense was this. The people who populated my field in the generation before me were the Manhattan Project people, or their immediate descendants. And they all had a relationship to technology in national defense that was natural and sustained. Wasn't always one where they didn't object to what was going on. There were fierce controversies in the technical community over whether to build an H-bomb originally, if you remember, and then over civil defense and missile defense and arms control and lots of other things. But the point is that they believed that bringing their expertise to bear on big questions was a responsibility that came with the knowledge of being a scientist. They also believed that they had invented what we would now call a disruptive technology, right? And they were proud of that. Because
you're talking about nuclear weapons.
Yes. They were proud of that because it had ended World War II.
Right.
And they were proud of it because, in their judgment, it had kept the peace for 50 years with the Soviet Union. But they also saw the huge dark side of an existential threat to humankind. And if you think about today's world, just parenthetically, one of the things I am doing now is evangelizing for the view that today's technologists should similarly see the bad as well as the good and involve themselves in minimizing the bad while maximizing the good. That's a lesson I learned. At any rate, so then
I managed to say there, do you think that that's happening less now than it did five
years
ago?
Oh, there's a whole generation in technology that either didn't participate because they didn't care or took things for granted, or because they had a downright aversion to working for the government, which they saw as a bad thing. And my view is, I don't always like what the government's doing either, but it's the only government we got.
Right.
And we have to get in there. If you don't like it, get in the game and make it better. So that was the spirit that the air in the rooms was infused with when I was a young physicist. And so when a very famous group, pair of physicists actually, came to me one day when I was a postdoc and said, Ash, you need to work on a certain problem in Washington. You only have to do it for a year, but somebody like you is needed. I said, yes. And I worked on it. It was what to do with the MX missile jack, which is ancient history now, but which is a huge U.S. intercontinental ballistic missile that was being built as the counter to a similarly large ballistic missile built by the Soviet Union in the old arms race days. And a particular issue arose about where to put it, and that turned out to be important strategically, but also complicated technically. And so I worked on that, and I had the feeling that I think every young person who decides upon a commitment in their lives has, which is, I saw my knowledge making a difference to a question that made a huge difference. You put those two things together and you're 20 something years old. That's pretty magical. And so at that point, I decided that I was going to continue to take advantage of it. I wasn't going to be in the government all the time, but continue to be committed to helping when I thought I could help and using my knowledge for the greater good.
And you had an extraordinary array of tasks and jobs, which we'll get to in a second. Is there something, do you think, about your this intensive scientific training as a background that gave you special insights or helped you in your career at DOD?
Well, if you compare it to other academic disciplinary backgrounds, it's unusual because there are a lot of political scientists, there are a lot of lawyers, there are a lot of business people, and so forth. And those are all valuable skill sets also. My view early in my life, this is somewhat arrogant, was that I could pick all that up on the fly. But you can't pick up physics on the fly. Now, what does physics get you when you're Secretary of Defense or something like that? It is a habit of mind that is it emboldens you to believe you can understand anything if you work hard enough at it. So when I was working on a problem, let's take it whether to admit women to all military specialties or to understand Syria and its geography and the peoples within it, or how the Joint Strike Fighter worked. I didn't feel that there was anywhere I couldn't go if I worked hard enough and understand. And I say that because, for example, even as capable a man as Leon Panetta, to whom I was deputy for a while during the time he was Secretary of Defense, he used to joke with me, "Ash, you know how everything works around here." Because if we were talking about a ship or a satellite or an airplane, I didn't have to take anything for granted. I could dig deep with a briefer who was superficial or wrong or trying to sell the secretary the wrong story. And so that's what I get out of it, a continuing emboldening. Really? Remember, we were arrogant. Physicists are arrogant, but we were very arrogant. And in those days, Jack, if you couldn't make it in physics, you became a computer scientist.
You still think that's true?
I still think physics is harder.
So another reason that you knew everything that was going on in the building when you worked for Leon Panetta is because you'd been working there on and off for decades, really. Yeah. You had a lot of jobs.
Since 1981.
Could you just briefly, because it's a long list, just tell us quickly the things, your basic history.
I was uninterruptedly a government employee from 1981 to when I walked out on Inauguration Day, handed the keys over to Jim Mattis in January of 2017. My first job was for Caspar Weinberger. Ronald Reagan was the Secretary of Defense. I worked for Cap Weinberger on a space, nuclear command and control, continuity of government, the whole Star Wars question. Then, and I'm skipping some things, but just for the big things, I was a scientific advisor to Paul Nitze, who a great cold warrior, who was Ronald Reagan's chief arms control advisor. I was, for years and years, on the Defense Science Board, which is the Secretary of Defense's science advisory board, for which you, as you know from your time in the Pentagon, requires you to be a special government employee. I was on Condi Rice's scientific advisory board. I was assistant secretary of defense in the Clinton administration, the defense policy board, and the defense science board in the Clinton administrations and the second Bush administrations. I was the undersecretary, which is the number three job for Obama, then the number two, the deputy secretary, the COO of the Department of Defense, and then finally the CEO. So I've been in lots of corners and lots of. I'm a one man bureaucratic.
So you know how the building runs, and it really comes through in the book. So you very vividly illustrate how enormous the Defense Department is. You say that it employs more men and women than Amazon, McDonald's, FedEx, Target, and General Electric combined. You say it does more research and development than Apple, Google, and Microsoft again combined. It manages more than half the U.S. federal budget, excluding entitlements and interest on the debt, a budget of more than $700 billion, and it owns and maintains more than 30 million acres of real estate, an area larger than the state of Pennsylvania. So this is one of the things I was struck with when I worked there, just the enormity of DOD. So the first question about that is, why does the United States need such an enormous defense department and defense presence?
Well, it's a good question, and it's a fair question, because it is half of the federal government in terms of discretionary spending, half of what the Congress appropriates and for government agencies to spend is in the Defense Department. So why? Here's one. Here are a couple ingredients to that. There's a lot of history in that answer, Jack, right, candidly, which is once you're at 700, 750, for political reasons, it's not going to go way up and it's not going to go way down.
Right.
So the real question, or another interpretation of the question is this money well spent? Is
there a rationale? That was my next question.
Is there a rationale for it?
Yeah.
Let me get to the waste question second. But just now, why 750? A couple ingredients go into that. One is that we have, in the here and now, China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, and terrorism. Five, just to take the biggies, the things that might trip off at any moment, the things which, if not deterred, will be big trouble for the security of America. All those potential enemies or real enemies have just us. If you think about the Chinese People's Liberation Army wakes up every morning thinking about the United States. The United States military and the Secretary of Defense, when I woke up every morning, I was thinking about the PLA, but I was also thinking about Russia, Iran, North Korea, and so forth. So we have a number of contingencies. Nobody else has that. And that's one reason why we need more stuff and we need it around the world. Another reason is that we pay our troops well and we get a huge benefit from that, which is the most skilled military, and it's the quality of our people and the quality of our technology that make us the best. There's nothing magical about being American. The reason why America has the best military is for those two ingredients. That doesn't come cheap. In today's, and particularly today's labor markets, we have to pay dearly to attract and retain those people, but it's worth it. In other countries, they conscript people, pay them very little, and it's much cheaper. We provide them with very good health care, which, like health care everywhere in the country, is escalating faster than general cost of living. So there are a number of reasons why we spend that much, some strategic, some just the way we do things. And that's just spending money on today's military. Another thing you have to do is invest for tomorrow. Because remember, all these guys are competing with us. So out of that 750, a couple of hundred is spent investing in the future. New technology, buying new systems, because speaking as the Secretary of Defense, I always used to say, I'm the Secretary of Defense of today, but I'm also the Secretary of Defense of tomorrow. And that this place has been around for 240 years. It's going to be around for a very, very, very long time in the future. And you are today's custodian of it. And I need to make sure that my successor and my successor's successor has as fine a military as the one that was bequeathed to me. And that takes money also. So it's today and tomorrow, it's the way our expenses are done as Americans about paying people decently and so forth. And there's a lot of history involved as well.
And how about, so you actually, to my surprise, opened the book talking about this. How about the waste question, which is always coming up?
And very good question.
Whether the resources are being allocated correctly, both within the DoD budget and across different types of
budgets. Yeah, let's just start with plain old waste first, and then we'll get to wrong-headed use of money, which is different from waste. I was a hawk on cost overruns and schedule overruns because they're disgraceful in their own right, because cost overruns mean that the taxpayer is having to pay more than they were told they were going to have to pay, and the warfighter is having to forego capability that would be bought with those dollars if it wasn't being wasted on the first program. And delay is intolerable because it means stuff gets in the hands of the warfighter later. And in wartime, especially, and, you know, we have been in wartime all the time. I was number three, number two, number one. We were at war. We can talk about those wars, and people have different views on them, but I was all in for them. It couldn't be otherwise. And a day's delay there literally meant the potential for the loss of life as well as the loss of effectiveness. So you can't have that stuff. And that's why when I was undersecretary, I canceled a lot of many programs. The presidential helicopter, for example, that was bloated and out of control. And it just had to be killed. So I canceled a lot of programs, and a lot of them that were in trouble, like the Joint Strike Fighter, I had to spend a lot of time rescuing from trouble. And I couldn't cancel them, or I didn't want to cancel them, because there wasn't a readily available alternative to them. And I couldn't punish the military for the bad performance of the managers on this one program. So I essentially had to manage it myself. But I was always aware, Jack, that I couldn't go to the taxpayer with a straight face and ask for $750 billion, that kind of money, if we were clearly wasting some of it. To the question of, are we buying the right stuff in the first place? Let's take the Joint Strike Fighter. That aircraft will be the next tactical aircraft for three of our armed services, the Air Force, the Navy, and the Marine Corps. And for many friends and allies around the world, it will be their next tactical aircraft and a lasting bond to the United States, which is valuable to me. Whatever people say about alliances today, I'm for them. But I do think it is probably the last manned tactical aircraft that will ever be built. So we need to be realistic that some of these things that we've associated with our military for a long time, infantrymen, many kinds of surface ships, big satellites, manned aircraft, these things are not going to, we're not going to be buying them 20 or 30 years. We need to begin to create the mentality that will willingly let go of those things. That's to your question about allocating. Are we spending money on the right things? I think we're doing okay now at allocating them to the China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, and terrorism threats. We weren't always. So I thought when I was in office that we were not doing nearly enough with respect to China and Russia. And the reason I disagreed with the crowd, so to speak, through the 2000 to say 2010 period, was that it had become clear to me, I think, before that it was clear to many people, that China and Russia, the China and Russia we'd hoped for in the 90s wasn't happening. And that we needed to be able to counter them, and they were a higher end enemy than the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. Second, we had spent all that time and energy on Iraq and Afghanistan and ultimately Syria. And was that a distraction? Yeah, it was. So you put those two things together, and China and Russia weren't getting the attention they needed to from the Defense Department for about 10 years. And one of the things I did in all three of my jobs was try to restore that attention to China and Russia. I think that's now more prevalent in the country, which is a good thing. Prevalent in Washington, which is a good thing. But it wasn't 10 years ago.
So let me ask you a question that follows up on that. So there were many places in the book, I'm thinking especially about your discussion, which we'll come back to, about the problem of ISIS, the Islamic State, when you got there and what you did to try to change our strategy on that. But one of the things that was apparent in that discussion was that you in the Defense Department and the intelligence community, and really more than that, perceived a threat that you thought required more U.S. engagement. The public wasn't necessarily on board for that. The president maybe not on board for that, at least for a while, or at least not confident he's on board for that. And that seems to be a
a general problem that you face in the Defense Department? I mean, you've had really President Obama and President Trump in one way or another ran on platforms of reducing DOD's footprint abroad. So you're the Secretary of Defense and you're responsible for keeping the nation safe and you perceive these threats, but the public is not there with you all the time and maybe the president's not there with you all the time. How do you think about that problem? How do you think about your responsibilities as SecDef when you face that problem?
Well, you're absolutely right. In the case of ISIS, to me, it was completely unacceptably running amok when I took office as Secretary of Defense in 2015. And I had been out of the department for several, many months, actually, eight months in between the time I was deputy and secretary. And when I came back, I was shocked. And we weren't doing enough. And it was completely, these are people who are crucifying people, who are enslaving women. And to me, that you can't have that. Now, you're right. There is, it in the country generally, and among presidents, very understandably, a disinclination to start wars. And I think that's been a general truth. These guys, all the presidents, the five presidents that I worked under, each took their responsibilities really seriously. And the idea that any of them, and I know that there was some controversy over George Bush II starting the Iraq War, but I think that in general, presidents and this country have been naturally and very commendably reluctant to use force and go to war. And there's a popular image that we in the Pentagon are just dying to start a war all the time. And that's false also, because the people who have done it or who do it take that responsibility really seriously too. At the same time, every once in a while, you got to do it. Now, remember, President Obama had campaigned on ending two wars. And not only didn't I want to end those two prematurely, but I was starting a third. That was a high hill to climb.
You're talking about the Islamic State?
Yeah. Right.
That was a high hill to climb. So
it's a high
hill. How do you think about that? Because you've got certain responsibilities. President was elected, making certain pledges. There's a reality on the ground. There's disagreement about what to do about it. I mean, how did you in general go about it?
I think the key was to show people that victory was possible, that it was doable, to put a plan in front of them that they could understand and say, this is what must be done and this is what can be done. And so when I put the plan together and the focus on Mosul and Raqqa in 2015 when I came in office, the Mosul and Raqqa were the two key objectives, but I had something else in mind as I briefed that to first the president and then publicly and to the troops, which is those newsreels in World War II, where there are two red arrows, one going to Tokyo and one going to Berlin. So everybody knew what the game was, what the objective was. And I wanted people to understand that there was a clear plan for doing this, and they should have confidence in it and try to give them that confidence by showing them the steps and showing them the progress. So if they see that it is doable and there's a plan, that's a big ingredient. The other thing is ISIS unfortunately conspired in making it increasingly clear that something had to be done. When you get some loser here in the United States all frizzed up on the internet who goes out, gets in his car and starts running people down in the street, people here begin to say that's enough. When there are people in Raqqa collecting the names of American government officials and service members, including yours truly, and their children and their families, and putting them on the internet and inviting people to go and attack them, that's when it begins to come home to people. I remember going to Davos, shortly after I got in office, because I wanted to emphasize technology, which we can talk about later. And so I just went over there for a day and did the usual thing with the snowfall in the background and right. Trying to get people's attention. One of the things I was trying to get people's attention to was this. But that at the same time, I'd have private meetings with leaders, not only world leaders, but business leaders. And all the business leaders said to me, you need to do something about ISIS. It's beginning to affect people's confidence. And first it'll hit tourism, but just more generally, my workforce, my people are perturbed, and that's moving towards fear. So here you have a few barbarians, relatively speaking, in Iran, and not relatively speaking of the barbarians, but relatively few, in Iraq and Syria, who really are having a major terror effect on the rest of the world. I'm supposed to protect the American people. One of the things I'm supposed to protect them from is the fear that they're going to get attacked. And so if you put that together, the rising fear and the fact that I had something to sell them, which was a doable plan, for President Obama himself and for the public at large, that proved to be the combination.
And how much, you talked about this briefly in the book, so you're coming in after we've been at war against various forms of Islamic terrorist organizations for 16 or 17 years. It's now 18 years, maybe it's 15 or 16 then. And there's a sense in which people are numb to war. They're disengaged from it to some extent. I take it that makes your job a lot harder. What do you make of that problem?
I think you have to take it for what it is, which is that we live in a country where the few defend the many. That is just a fact. It's not going to change. We're not have a draft. We're not going to have a greatest generation. We have a relatively small number of people devoted to defending the rest of the population. And the rest of the population needs to understand enough to accept that that is being done on their behalf and to give some support to it. And people, they've been at it now for almost two decades, watching what's going on. Now, most of them themselves, all they're doing is watching TV. So you say, why are you tired of the war?
Right.
Are you tired of watching it on TV?
I agree. Yeah.
I know people who are really tired of the war. Right. They're people who don't have legs.
Right.
And the wives of people who don't have legs. And the mothers and fathers of people who don't. I know people who are really tired of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But you've only been watching it on TV. At the same time, they are citizens. They require
support. And the war is being fought in their name.
Yeah.
And they need to understand it.
Exactly. And so there's a huge burden on you as Secretary of Defense to support the enunciation of the policy and to help the president enunciate. I will say that President Obama had many, many strengths, and he almost invariably did the right thing, in my judgment, even when it was unpopular and against his fundamental inclinations. So, for example, he did agree to my request to not only not draw down the number of troops in Afghanistan, but increase it slightly. He agreed, every time I asked him something for ISIS, the answer was yes. And I knew that went against his grain. He had many, many good features. One thing he did not do well was explain. And that's interesting because he was a great communicator in lots of other ways. But in respect of war, he was not a great communicator. And there was nobody else in the administration. John Kerry was mostly working on the very important negotiations right. He was conducting. So fair enough. The National Security Advisor, Susan Rice, and before her, Tom Donilon, they don't normally give speeches. So there aren't that many people in the government who can authoritatively talk about war. The Secretary of Defense is one. The best is the president, but as I said, it wasn't President Obama's choice.
Obama was a good explainer at some things, at many things, but I agree, not good at explaining military strategy in general and military operations in general. But he came to office being someone who was peace inclined. And do you think that he was just dispositionally uncomfortable with that?
No, I think it was, Jack, that he did not want to be his predecessor, whom he thought oversimplified, and particularly in the matter of the Iraq War. And so there was always, every president runs against the last guy to some extent. And I don't think President Obama ever fully stopped wanting not to oversimplify. Now, what that means, though, is that you stand up and your manner is very didactic, off-putting, chilly, as he himself would say about himself in that mode. And it wasn't the kind of thing that got people convinced and determined and maybe even a little bit angry. Because if you're going to wage war, you have to have a little head of steam up emotionally. And so in the case of ISIS, you had to be angry and you had to be determined these people needed to be destroyed and you needed to want to get it done. And you needed it, and if you were trying to get the other people to feel that way, it wasn't oversimplification, but it was giving the full emotional import of the need to go to war. And that was something that was not in his playbook of speeches. And I think it had a lot to do with his view of his predecessor and his campaign rhetoric and so forth.
So let me ask you what might be a related question, I'm not sure. A perpetual criticism from the Department of Defense during the Obama years was that the White House micromanaged the battlefield. And you actually talk about this a lot. I think you have a chapter on it, and it's discussed throughout the book. So in your view, what was the problem and what were your main responses to
Well, what I say in the book is I didn't have the experience that my predecessors complained about of micromanagement. And here's my unfolding.
But in part, let me just interrupt there, please. In part, that's because you did something about it. You talk about times where, I forget the proposed
concept of operation,
and it was being vetted by the NSC before it went to the president. It's supposed to be advice coming from you, so you changed that. So there were things that, but you fixed them.
Yes, like. I did. I made it my business to not be micromanaged. Now you say, well, how can you do that? The president outranks you.
That's what I want to
micromanage you.
Right.
And to me, the right answer is the good old-fashioned answer. I needed to have Barack Obama have the confidence that when Ash Carter came to the sit room or sent him a proposal, that I had worked as hard on it as he thought it needed to be worked on and as he would work on it. If he didn't have that confidence, if he thought the Pentagon was just sending him stuff, which we could do, and the Secretary of Defense hadn't beforehand vetted it as though he were the president himself. That's my job, after all.
That's the important part. That's your job, and that's the way the chain of command.
And I wanted to win from President Obama the confidence that when we, the Department of Defense, sent something to him, Ash had really looked at it hard. Otherwise, he would do the thing he had to do, which is turn to his staff and say, you better check this. I think it came up from the lower levels and the guys at the top just sent it on over. And there's probably something wrong in there and I'll be held responsible. And so
it makes sense.
I had to earn that slowly because there was a habit of having the staff look over our shoulders. I didn't like that. And I changed some of our internal procedures and above all, my own involvement in such a way that slowly, but surely, the president came to have confidence in what I was doing. Also, I need to say, Jack, that when I first worked for Weinberger, for example, Weinberger would sooner die than let anybody outside the Defense Department talk about war plans to the president. He believed that it was only the president and the Department of Defense and hell with everybody else. That was the spirit and the reality of the Cold War days.
Right.
If the war went up, it was all war. Today, in things like Iraq and Afghanistan, but even if we were dealing with Russia and China, there is inevitably a political and a intelligence and an economic side to things. So I did not have the view that the president wouldn't benefit from and that my war plans wouldn't benefit from diplomatic input and intelligence. But it's just I sought it out. Because sometimes they would say, well, you don't really understand how that country works, or you haven't understood how this tribe or this locality works. These were valuable insights to us. Why would we ever forego them? And provided they could keep secrets, which they invariably could, and their inputs were in good faith. Sometimes they would then later argue to the president and the National Security Council against a proposed operation on policy grounds. Fine, I would argue for doing it on policy grounds. But beforehand, I would have let them see what I was proposing and say, tell me what you think. Most of the time, I benefited from that. Sometimes I bought myself a debate that I wished I didn't have to have, but we debated it in front of the president.
Yeah, so that, my experience in government was always better to have those debates beforehand rather than afterwards. But it seems to me the key thing, if I had to generalize from all the things you said in the book that you did, was you wanted to get that input yourself before you gave the president the advice, rather than you sending the White House the advice and then letting everyone there weigh in. Is that fair?
Yes, and you have to be a stickler for the chain of command. Chain of command goes from the president to the Secretary of Defense to everybody else. And my view is nobody else is sending anything up towards the president that doesn't go through Ash Carter. And likewise, but conversely, nobody in the White House can give instructions to the Department of Defense. The only time I ever saw the really mild-mannered former Secretary of Defense, Bill Perry, a good friend of mine, stood in for my father at my wedding, in fact. The only time I've ever seen Bill really angry was when a White House staffer gave orders to a DOD general. So I was a real stickler on that. And when somebody would come to me and say, the White House says this or that, I would say, you don't listen to the White House. There's one person in the White House you listen to. That's Barack Obama. Sometimes I would get, before I gave a speech, Jack, in another country, I'd get the White House comments. And they'd want you to change this, that, and the other thing. Sometimes that was very helpful. And I would look at them. But I wouldn't make the changes I didn't want to. And then I'd always wait to see if the phone would ring. And if the President of the United States said to me, Ash, you need to cool it on this or that subject or something, that's one thing. But if it's anybody else...
Otherwise, it was your call, not theirs.
Yeah, I'll take it as input, but that not as an order.
Okay, so I'm going to switch topics. You have a really fascinating discussion of cyber issues in the book, and we're not going to be able to discuss most of them, unfortunately. I want to talk about offensive cyber. In the book, you continued some comments that you, along the lines that I think you've made publicly in the past. You said combatant commanders seemed reluctant to develop cyber offensive capabilities as part of their war planning tasks, and you did something about that. And you also talk about Cyber Command failing to deliver much help in the campaign against ISIS, which echoes something you said in 2017. So this is surprising for outsiders. Why is there an institutional reluctance to use offensive cyber weapons? And how, if at all, Lawfare readers understand Cyber Command and the basic issues about Cyber Command, how does that reluctance, if at all, relate to the structure of Cyber Command and the future of Cyber Command? That's a big set of questions.
Yeah, it is. Well, the reluctance was partly political. It was considered very controversial, whether we were going to do offensive cyber, and it was a policy decision that had not been made by the country in general. And so there was kind of a taboo about it when I came into office. I didn't think it was appropriate, but there's no question that it was there. But that didn't explain our, in my view, general incompetence. So what does explain it? One is that I don't think we were managing the problem. I could go into more detail about that, but, you know, and how we structured CyberCom and the incentives and the people we gave it. Marty Dempsey and I basically established the fundamental structure of it when I was deputy, and we staffed it with military. And that was because we could put them quickly in this new agency, not because we thought that was the right talent mix for the long run. So we didn't have quite the right talent mix. CyberCom was the stepchild of the National Security Agency. We put it out in Maryland so it could use the National Security Agency. The National Security Agency is a spy agency.
Right.
And you get run into the eternal problem, Jack, of do you listen to their communications or do you disrupt their communications? As long as there's been warfare and espionage, there's been that. It's a tactical debate in every single case. And the intelligence community was powerful, and sometimes they could put the kibosh on it. Next, you get to the fact that the infrastructure for cyber attacks tends to be a global infrastructure. And, you know, if we're going to bomb a country and we're going to fly over another country to bomb it, we need to ask the permission of the country we're overflying. In cyber, there are similar kind of overflight issues where you're going through a server in Germany
legal
or
issues.
Italy. Legal issues, which, as you well know from your own.
Among others. Political issues, diplomatic issues.
Yeah. And so there were so many reasons to say no. The intelligence community would say no. The taboo would say no. The diplomats would say no. And on top of that, we didn't have the right competence anyway. So that's a lot. That's more than three strikes against you. Now, that's not a good answer. I'm just giving you an honest answer. It's unacceptable.
Right. Well, so I think we have time for one more question. You famously, I think, tried to build bridges between DOD and Silicon Valley. So why do those, there were some bridges there. I think you tried to make them bigger and deeper. And why do these bridges need to be built? How did things stand when you left? And where do they stand today?
They need to be rebuilt because the bridge I walked across when I was a young physicist, the bridge that was built by the Manhattan Project generation, that bridge was in disuse and disrepair in the generation that followed. Many technologists were simply intent on making money. Some had the libertarian philosophy that somehow good would come without the government. Some looked at Edward Snowden as a hero, or to me, he's a traitor. And some were just so absorbed with making money that the public purpose wasn't high on their screen. So there was a generation that was only minimally involved in defense matters. That's what happened to the bridge between the time I started and when I came back into office in 2009. Those bridges I wanted to rebuild. And I had to do that despite the Snowden overhang, despite the romance with startups and get rich quick. And that took a lot of work. And it had to be a relationship of trust. And I used to tell people who looked at me quite skeptically, whether in the Valley or in Boston or in Austin or whatever tech hub I was in, they'd be looking at you quite skeptically. And I promised them, I said, I'll meet you halfway. I say, if it's, you know, Edward Snowden is on your mind, we're just going to have to agree to disagree. And if you're worried about whether your dress, your dyed hair, your nose rings, your ear, all that's fine. We can deal with all that. I'll meet you halfway. And try to get them to devote a part of their life, like you have, Jack, and certainly like I have a large chunk of my life, to doing something that's bigger than yourself. And I got enough people to answer the call, and I got enough industry and tech leaders to answer the some are clueless, but not all are clueless.
And last thing, why, can you explain for the listeners why this is important? I'll tell you why I think it's important, but I don't know what I'm talking about compared to you. It used to be that a lot of technological innovation happened within the government, and it still does, but enormous amounts of technological innovation that's relevant to national security and national defense is now happening outside the government. And I take it that's one reason, for national security and defense reasons, why this relationship needs to be improved. Is that fair?
You know, it's very fair. We cannot grow our own or rely upon what we grow intramurally any longer. The global and particularly commercial tech bases are too big and moving too fast. And if we're going to be the firstest with the mostest, as Lyndon Johnson used to say, with new technology, we have to draw a lot of that from the commercial sector. That means having a relationship of trust and where people and ideas go back and forth. That's why the bridge is even more important today than it was then.
I have one more question, and that has to do with lawyers, which I was a little surprised by. It's one of the important institutions in DOD that you didn't devote an enormous amount of time to in the book. So my basic question is, how did you view working with lawyers? There are 15,000 or so lawyers in the defense establishment. And how did you work with lawyers? How did you find lawyers? I think Eric Rosenbach is himself a lawyer.
Yes,
he was your
chief of staff.
And how did the role and influence of lawyers change over your decades in the Pentagon?
Well, first of all, I repeatedly said, and I do say in the book, that the Department of Defense takes the values of America enshrined in law, not only our national law, but in the law of armed conflict and international understandings about proportionality and discrimination. We take all that to the battlefield. I make no apologies about that. We're not the Russians. And when we decide what we're doing, and women and children are involved, and so forth, those are red lights for us. And I make no bones about that. And therefore, nothing that I ever did was, in no case did I ever fail to get legal input and to be assured that what I was doing was lawful. That's why the office that you were in is so central. Nothing happens. The most secret stuff is known in that office, because it has to be.
You're talking about the General Counsel's office.
Yes, the General Counsel of the Department of Defense, right. And we had wonderful ones during my time. Now, that said, one of the jobs of a good lawyer is to keep you out of trouble, stop you from doing that which you shouldn't do, but another is to help you to do what you want to do.
Right.
And I had good counsels in that respect, too. And one of the stories I tell in the book was when the shutdown was coming, and I learned that the shutdown would prohibit us from making death penalty payments to the widows of people who perished on the battlefield. That infuriated me, that for these stupid reasons of gridlock in Washington, the government would be shut down and I would be forbidden to do that. So I called up a philanthropist in New York, who I knew was patriotic-minded, and said to him, how about giving me a few million dollars, or giving these widows a few million dollars? And my general counsel sat there in my office shaking his head, and he had told me that I couldn't do this in all probability,
right.
And I was doing it anyway. So sometimes I took the risk. Another big one, and Jack, which you know extremely well, is the whole conversation over the authorization of the use of military force. That's fundamentally a legal issue, but it's bigger than that. It has to do with the involvement of Congress in war, which the Constitution reposes important, indeed the principal responsibility for deciding whether there will be a war or not in the Congress. The conduct of the war in the executive branch, for sure, but the decision to in the Congress. And then you say to yourself, well, how can I be fighting ISIS in Libya, which I was, or in Syria, which I was, or in Afghanistan, which I was? Why did Congress ever authorize that? And as you well know, all of what we did went back to 2001, the Al-Qaeda authorization, and 2003, the Iraq authorization. And our lawyers continued to assure us that the things we were doing were reasonable descendants of those antecedents, and therefore it was lawful for us to continue. At the same time, there was a view in the Congress that they needed to refresh that authorization. And I was okay with that, and I testified favorably towards that, subject to two conditions. The two conditions were that the new authorization mustn't tie my hands with the things that I reasonably thought would be needed and might be needed to defeat ISIS and terrorism elsewhere, which really meant that it should confine itself to a long, large, anticipated war. If it's long and large, then there's time and there's magnitude for Congress to act. But I didn't want to have my hands tied short of that.
What was the second condition?
The second was that the process and the product be enthusiastically supportive of the troops when the authorization permitted them to fight. They didn't deserve to be sent to war without a strong, warm wind to their backs from the American people. And for their sake, I said, it needs to be not a grudging sending of them to war, but a enthusiastic, firmly committed sending to war. Those were my two criteria. And I thought they might have been met on around 2015 or so when I testified that way. Turns out they weren't.
That's a great place to stop. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Good to be with you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Secretary Carter for coming on the show. If you haven't yet, please take a second to share the Lawfare Podcast on social media and give us a 5-star rating and review wherever you found us. You can also now purchase Lawfare swag at our online store, www.thelawfarestore.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell. Our audio engineer this week was one Jack Goldsmith, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.